No, I need the
Mary weep and
Marty. There's an extension cord right there. I hope the rest, perhaps you'll also become aware of some research tools and techniques that you can use yourselves. And also perhaps you'll learn to refresh your memories on some forgotten historical and geographical facts. Although we're often conditioned to dwell on the differences between ethnic and racial groups, between different segments of the population, I hope that what will happen today, that this presentation will instead make you more aware of the similarities between people. So consequently, we're going to be concentrating not so much on what we usually term as the black experience, but on the American experience and how black people shared in that. So therefore, this will not just be the story of my own family, but in some sense, it's the story of all of you, because as Odetta sings in this song, everyone has to some extent and degree put your hand on the plow and held on. Okay? Now, I have a little more. Sometime between the years 1830 and 1845, there lived in Wilson County, Tennessee, a small landholder and a slave owner by the name of Gaines. And those of you who know my parents know that that was my maiden name. He was a bachelor, and before he died, he called in a lawyer, or whoever you call in under the circumstances, and had papers drawn up which freed his slaves and divided his land among them. One of these slaves was my great-grandfather on my father's side of the family. Eventually, this great-grandfather, whose name I don't even know, married and had a son, Thomas Gaines, who inherited this land from his father, the ex-slave. Thomas grew up during the period of the Civil War, and that was my grandfather, again on my father's side of the family. During the same period, in another county in Tennessee, Coffee County, any of you who are from there, there was another slave family by the name of Johnson. My father says that his mother used to tell him how at the end of the Civil War, when she was about 15 years old, she and her two brothers loaded everything they owned on their backs and started walking northward. They only got as far as Wilson County, where they settled and where they got to know the Gaines family. Thomas Gaines and Nancy Johnson eventually married, settled on the Gaines property, and raised 10 children, the youngest of which, born when my grandmother was in her early 50s in 1896, was my father. And my father, in turn, decided to move north when he was about 15 years old, and after wandering through Louisiana, Pennsylvania, Kentucky, finally wound up in Grand Rapids, Michigan, where he met my mother. And this is my mom at the age of 17 in 1921. Is this focused fine? You can all see back there. George and Doris fell in love and had two children. Guess who one of them was?
The girl.
Yes. And this is in 1932. And I want you to know that this 50-year-old picture is going to be the most recent slide or picture you'll see for the rest of the morning in this. So this is the modern photography. Okay. Now, the story of my father's side of the family would probably be a very interesting one if I were able to tell it, but I'm not. It would probably be very much like Alex Haley's Roots, which you're probably familiar with. But I never knew my father's parents. His father died in 1904, and his wife, his mother, Nancy, in 1934. And I've only known a few of the other relatives on my dad's side of the family. Because he was born so late in his mother's life, and because he left home at such an early age, he himself barely knew most of his relatives and had little contact with them as he or we grew up. They barely left records, any records of their lives, no letters, no history, no stories passed on from parent to child, and no pictures. But fortunately, on the other hand, I was blessed on my mother's side of the family with a grandmother who kept records of everything and everybody. And also, this side of the family seemed to feel that a frequent trips to the photographers were neither a waste of time nor a waste of money. So it will be my mom's side of the family that I'll be talking about this morning. So we'll try and avoid confusion, which is not probable, but we'll first discuss my mother's side of the family, or the McLarens, and then we'll come back and take up her father's side of the family, the Clarks or the Normans. Now this next picture, I hope you'll be able to, we have a missing slide. Okay, Al, do you see a slide that has a little tab at the top of it further down?
Lift.
Take the screw, the top thing off that screws it. Yeah. Can you see that at all?
No.
Listen, Al, unscrew that top thing because I want to move. There are two slides in here that I want to move into some empty spaces in the. I don't think you may not see it any better. Can you see it better now? Okay. This is Rosetta McLaren, who was my great-great-grandmother. She was born in Gallipolis, Ohio in 1837. And an aura of mystery surrounds her origins and background. Much of what we know is founded on a few facts, bolstered by conjecture and propped up by historical and geographical information. For instance, this is what her obituary said in a Saginaw, Michigan newspaper in 1920. I think you have to open that draper or the readers can't read. You need the draper. Oh, okay.
Mrs. Rosetta McLaren, 83 years old, died Monday at the home of her nephew, C.L. Johnson, 138 South 11th Street. She was the descendant of a Blackfoot Indian tribe and was born near Washington, Cornwall, Ohio, January 29, 1837. She came to Michigan at the age of 17. Her husband, Reverend Joseph McLaren, died a number of years ago. She leaves two children, Mrs. Aurora Goins of Saginaw and George Willard McLaren of Chicago.
Okay, one of the things that we're not sure about on that, from that obituary, they mentioned the fact that her Indian ancestry was Blackfoot, but if you you know, you got that in? The Blackfeet Indians were Plains Indians, and their home was much further west in the area of Montana, and it's very unlikely or doubtful that during this period you would find Blackfeet Indian traveling from the west, moving eastward this way, especially when the government's policy, Indian policy at that time, was complete removal of the Indian tribes to the west. Now, what I'd like to point out here, there is the possibility that a couple of isolated members of the Blackfoot tribe may have somehow or other hooked up with a fur voyageur or a fur trader or someone like that and moved back east with them. You'll see when we move along, the people were not adverse to traveling some very long distances to get where they wanted to go, even though they did not have modern transportation. One of the things that we figured the person who wrote this obituary should have known what they were talking about, but still we find that kind of confusing. If you noticed in the picture, the color, Rosetta's coloring, she was, and we'll show another picture where you'll see this a little better later on. She's very dark in color, and that was one of the racial characteristics, or is one of the racial characteristics of the Blackfeet Indian. They are not very, they're not real fair as some of the other Indian tribes are, so that's one thing that may have be some truth in that. There's reason to believe that she's more likely a Shawnee Indian. In the period immediately following the Revolutionary War, the treaties were ceding their territory were drawn up with the Ojibways, the Delaware, and the Potawatomis, who inhabited the areas of eastern Michigan and northeastern Ohio. And the central and southern part of Ohio here was traditionally the home of the Shawnees, and the Washington Courthouse that Rachel mentioned in the obituary was originally called Shawnee Town and was the home of the Shawnee Indians, so we suspect that might be a possibility. The obituary does not make clear whether she was a full-blooded Indian, but we suspect that she was not. My grandmother's notes say that either her father or her grandfather was a Frenchman from Gallipolis by the name of De Jeannette. And in the early 1800s, Gallipolis, which lay right on the Ohio River there, and I think it doesn't...
Yeah, it's right down on the border.
It's right on the border here between Ohio and what would be West Virginia, I think, right now, was a French village, and it was inhabited primarily by French fur traders. And of course, it's a matter of historical fact that most of those voyageurs and fur trappers were married to or cohabited with Indian women. So thus, that my grandmother's story may very possibly be true. And when you see some of pictures of Rosetta's children, they were extremely fair in color as opposed to her dark coloring. So she probably was mixed blood. We think also that she had some black blood in her, because Gallipolis, in addition to being a port of embarkation for the French fur traders, was also, like all of the river towns along the Ohio River there, a point of entry for escaping slaves, and had a history of numerous free blacks in the community. Now, we know that her sister was married to a black man, and the nephew that's mentioned in this obituary was black, and that the family had always considered itself as being a black family. At any rate, one of the things that I find very interesting when I look at this picture is the immense cultural leap that occurred in such a short period of time. If you take a look at that, regardless of her origins, if her grandmother or her mother, one, at least were born to the lodge and the teepee, to the deerskin and the fur, and not speaking the English language, and suddenly here within a period of 30 to 40 years, you see this daughter having her photograph taken, dressed in the latest European fashions, with her hair in long curls, and speaking in a completely new language. For those of you who are interested in genealogy, I'll just say a word or two about dating this picture, because it's something that you might apply to things that you have yourself. The original photo here is what is known as an ambrotype, and this is a photographic process which was meant to replace the daguerreotype, and it came into use in about 1851, and it was superseded by the tintype in 1871. So you see, you can place the dating of your picture between those two points. This particular type of photograph, for some reason, was never very popular, I'm told, and examples of the amber type are comparatively rare. Within the 20-year span, you can further date your pictures by checking on the dress and the hairstyle of the people that are photographed. For instance, married women and girls over the age of 18 did not wear their hair in long curls like this, so you know that this is a photo of an unmarried woman under the age of 18. Usually, if you were married or older, your hair was pinned up on top of your head. So, we assume this picture was taken before Rosetta's wedding, and we date it somewhere between 1851 and 1855. We assume it was taken for some very special occasion. She left Ohio and moved to Michigan in 1851 at the age of 17. So we're assuming this picture was either taken on the occasion of her leaving Michigan, but more likely it's probably the picture that was taken before her wedding. Okay. Now, Al, if you would take that slide of the map, I'll out and replace it in that empty space. And then we'll move on here to, okay. Now, this is Rosetta's husband, Reverend Joseph McLaren. Now, we have unanswered questions about Rosetta. We have even more more interesting ones about him. The U.S. Census for 1850 shows that there was a Joseph McLaren and a brother, Edward McLaren, living in Holmes County in Washington Township, Ohio. That's in the northeastern part of Ohio. And from this point on, there's very little mention of him, and no mention at all of his brother, who completely dropped out of sight. Again, if you notice the photo taken from an ambrotype, he's wearing, this is a clerical collar, a little different from the ones we know. And in one of the pictures, he's holding either a Bible or a prayer book. According to my grandmother's records, he spoke several languages. My grandmother said seven, but sometimes she was a little prone to exaggerate. And he had been educated and as an Episcopalian priest. And one of the things that had come down in our family, and we lost at the time my grandmother died in 1948, but we had an Episcopalian Book of Common Prayer that was inscribed with his name and the date 1859 on the fly leaf, and it was printed with English on one side and some Indian language, we don't know which one, on the opposite side of the page. So it was a dual language prayer book. The big question is where and how he got his education. Episcopalian missions were not really that big, I don't think, in this part of the country. The Baptists and the Catholic Church had it wrapped up around the Midwest. But there was a school, an Episcopalian school in Mackinac, and another one near Saginaw, Michigan, that educated and trained Indian youth at this time. And at some time, I remember reading that there were 8 Episcopalian priests, Indian priests, educated somewhere in this area. And then at the time, I wasn't doing the genealogy. And I said, oh, that, you know, gee, that's interesting. That must, and I tucked it away. But when I got ready to look this up, I couldn't remember where I had read that, so I never was able to go back and check it. Okay. We're not sure how these two met, whether they met in Ohio or whether they met after Rosetta had moved to Michigan. But after they married, they lived in Marshall, Michigan, where at least one of their children was born. He was 50 years old when he married the 20-year-old Rosetta, and we think this probably was his wedding picture also. He died not many years after that in Van Wert, Ohio, which is near the border of Indiana. We don't know whether Rosetta was with him at the time or not, but at any rate, after his death, the records indicate that she was again living in Michigan, and we don't know the year of his death either. The oldest of their three children and was Samantha, and I gather this is, you probably can't see this very well, but it's interesting for the clothing and so forth. This picture is taken approximately 1881, probably around the time of her marriage at the age of 16 to a man by the name of Albert Reed. And they had three children. She died at the age of 19. And there's no record of what happened to her children. However, we understand that after her death, her husband packed up and moved west, and no one ever heard from him again. The second of Rosetta and George's children was a son, George McLaren, born in 1865. This photo is taken about 1879 to 81. When he was about 14, 15 years old. And here's the same man as an adult, and this is my very favorite picture. I just think he is so handsome. But that was a long time ago. This picture was taken about 1890, and he moved to Chicago. He married a woman who was about 17 years older than he, and had they had one child. The child died at the age of 9. His wife died soon after that, and he never remarried, though he lived to be quite old. I don't know why no one ever grabbed him. I maybe wasn't as nice a person as he as his looks here, because looks aren't everything, right? Anyhow, when he died, the McLaren name sort of disappeared from the family history, although we, you know, there may be some McLarens from that missing uncle that nobody ever heard of again. The third child on the left of this picture was a daughter, Aurora, and this was my great-grandmother. She's pictured here with her cousin Florence, who is the daughter of Rosetta McLaren's sister, Elizabeth. And Florence later on moved to Chicago, and we don't know what happened to her side of the family either. In 1881, Aurora, the lady on the left, married a man by the name of James Mays. Now we'll see whether this, okay. And she moved with him from Saginaw to Sheboygan, Wisconsin. When I say these people like to move around, okay, Saginaw is right up in here somewhere, and I don't know whether they sailed around or what, but they ended up over, I think that Sheboygan should be right about there, okay? Okay, and, he was a seaman, and he worked on one of the Great Lakes ships, sailing, we think, from Sheboygan up around the Straits of Mackinac to Bay City, Michigan.
These sailors might steal a cargo of corn from the fresh water of the Great Lakes, but there is no record of any complaint that the winds and weather over the
Dick here? Well, I'll read. I didn't know he wasn't here. The routine was well set in tradition. The holes were filled and the hatches battened down at the wharves. The efficient bustle of getting underway began. Then from the quarter deck by the wheel came the shouted order, all hands make sail. On the lake ships, that would mean a couple of mates and a dozen sailors or so. Then the sails are trimmed to the Lake Erie wind, and the ship spreading out a half acre or more of canvas crowds her way up toward Detroit, Saginaw, Mackinac, Chicago, Milwaukee, Sheboygan, and Manitowoc.
Generally, the hands sang as they worked the ropes and halyards. Singing while you worked with one of the stations on the lake. There was no time for singing, however, when a cold frontal storm broke over the lake, or a squall struck at the top canvas with devastating fury. The watches on the Great Lakes have always been stupendous. The weather is full of vagaries, the storms are fierce and tremendous, and there is no room on the narrow lakes for a ship in distress to run before them as they can upon the ocean. In the two decades between 1878 and 1898, 5,999
vessels were wrecked on each lake. 1,093 of them were total losses of both ships and cargo, and an appalling number of men.
There was no time for singing, however, when the cold frontal storms broke over the lakes, or a squall struck at the taut canvas with devastating fury. Oh, that's the last section.
Oh, I thought there was a I'm sorry. Excuse me. We are having a hard time here.
Just do what I'm told.
I think Mona read the wrong one.
I should be two.
Oh, I'm sorry. That was a nice place.
You stole the good part. Generally, the hands sang as they worked the ropes and halyards. Singing while you work was one of the traditions of the lakes. On American ships, the Irishmen, of whom there were always a few in every crew, were admitted to the ranks ahead of the white Americans as shantymen, though they, in turn, were outstripped by the American Negroes, the best singers that ever lifted a shanty aboard a ship.
Well, anticlimactic that may be. My great-grandfather, James May, was one of the seamen who lost his life in one of those Great Lakes shipping disasters. And he was drowned in Lake Michigan at the age of 28. And at that point, Aurora once again packed her belongings. Now, remember, she's in Sheboygan now. And packed her belongings, and with her infant daughter, Jessica, who had been born in Sheboygan, made another lake voyage around the straits and down, and went back home to Saginaw, Michigan. When she arrived in Saginaw, she secured work as a housekeeper for a medical doctor by the name of Pick, and she remained in his employ for many years. When Jessica grew up to be school age, and this is my grandmother we're talking about now, he arranged for her to attend a Catholic boarding school in Bay City and paid for her education. And my mother still remembers the Pick family for whom my great-grandmother was working when my mom was a little girl. In 1902, Jessica Mays married Howard Clark, and in 1904, they had their only child, who was to be my mother, Doris Irene Clark, whom some of you know. And this is my mom at 4 months of age in 1904. You notice the elaborate Victorian wicker furniture of the day. This was her christening picture, and I believe this christening outfit is still stored away someplace. Okay, so it's this infant who grew up, met George Gaines, and had me. This July, she'll be 81 years old, and she's living in Madison, Wisconsin. So thus, we've made a full circle of that McLaren branch of the family. Now I'm going to backtrack, and we'll take a look at the side of the family from which my mother's father came, the Clark or Norman family. Let's see if this, hope this one's working. Rosemary here?
No more driver.
Rosemary Dorney? Who wants to volunteer? I need a volunteer. You can start that right now. Wait a minute. Elizabeth. I think I gave you the wrong page. Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
The tiny village of Nacosta lies in west central Michigan in the heart of a cut-under stump country. Herschel Cross, an historically bonded member of the pioneer Negro clan, proved most helpful, guiding me to his older kinfolk and other octogenarians in the area. Setting them at ease, then sitting back to savor the gossipy folk history which they poured forth. Uncle Amos Cross responded to my questions immediately. The patriarch of a fruitful tribe, born in Remus in 1870, the year after his folks moved north from Ohio, Uncle Amos spoke proudly of his slave father who grew up in Loudoun County, Virginia, and planted a noble tribe in this Michigan stump country. Taking down a 61-year-old photograph, Uncle Amos showed me a picture of himself as a young man, surrounded by his parents and 17 brothers and sisters. Of them all, only he still lived. Straight and tall, hollow cheeks and deep voice with age, Uncle Amos rumbled genially about runaway slaves and the white woman who had followed them north. When 77-year-old George Norman, swarthy and mustachioed, sat on a hay bundle in the middle of a field his uncle had homesteaded, and told us his great-grandfather had wedded a white woman from Virginia with hair as red as fire, Herschel slapped his thigh and whistled in amazement. So that's where all those red-headed Normans come from. A bizarre genealogy unfolded from one after another old settler as we poked into their past. The light-skinned spoke of German and Scottish and Polish ancestors, the dark of slave and Indian forebears. European and African, free and bond, white and black, had mingled dramatically in these families.
Well, you can imagine my surprise when I first read that passage in a book entitled American Negro Folk Tales by Richard Dorson, who's the professor of folklore at the University of Illinois at Champaign. The Normans you just heard reference to, as well as the Crosses, were a part of my family, and the last thing I expected to do was just pick up a book and read something like this about them. Yeah. The original Norman who entered Ohio from Virginia, what is now the state of West Virginia, was Henry Norman, who escaped from slavery with the daughter of his owner, or perhaps the daughter herself may have owned him. Just ignore this picture for a minute. Henry Norman and the woman that he escaped from slavery with were married when they got to Ohio, and they settled somewhere around the city of Zanesville and proceeded to raise a family consisting of six daughters and a son, all of whom did indeed inherit that flaming red hair. This is a picture of one of the Norman girls, Betsy Norman Lett, who is pictured with two of her four children, Grace Lett and Sina Lett. And this slide is made from an old tintype and dates from around 1880. This is a picture of another of the Norman girls, Julia Norman Miller, also taken from a tintype and taken about 1888. I don't have a lot of information about these people themselves. This is the same woman, Julie Norman Miller, holding her son, Russell, who was known as Cap. This, again, a tintype and dated about 1873. An earlier picture than the other one. The third of the six Norman girls, Ellen Norman, is the mother of one of the few Norman cousins whom I knew personally. Her daughter, at the time I gave this program 9 years ago, was in a nursing home in Grand Rapids. And we haven't heard, she moved to California, and I suspect that she was 90 then, so I suspect that she died, and we had no communication about it. This photo was taken about 1878, and that's also from a tintype. I don't have photos of the son, George Norman, nor do I have pictures of the other two girls, Dilly Norman and Fran Norman, but this is a photo of Angeline Norman Clark, who was my great-grandmother. And in 1880, she married a William Elwood Clark in Renville, Ohio. Now, William Elwood Clark, pictured here about 1883, and his brother Lewis Clark had been born in Bowling Green, Virginia, about 1850. I'm not sure whether this next picture is the brother Lewis or whether it's the same person. And I tend to think that these might be the same person, but they sort of look like they are. At any rate, William and his brother Lewis were born in Bowling Green, Virginia. Whether they were born slave or free, we're not really sure, but we think they were born into slavery. A cousin of mine remembers my great-grandfather telling her as a child about his memories of the end of the Civil War and of the rejoicing and the singing and the dancing and the feasting that took place when the news was announced that the slaves were free. And the parents of these two boys had died when they were very young, and they had been raised by a neighbor woman. But when the war ended, she was no longer able to take care of them, and there was no living to be made in the area around Bowling Green, Virginia. So the oldest boy, William, at 16, and Lewis, just a year and a half younger than he, enlisted in the Army and were sent to the Southwest, where they both served in the United States Army for about 25 years. Mm-hmm.
Okay. At the end of the Civil War, General Grant had said, "Let us have peace." And between the North and the South, there was peace in the sense of no further fighting. The old war, begun so long ago, when the white man first set foot on the shores of America, never had ceased, and it had never been finished.
The bugles call again, and the drums roll. Colors and diamonds uncased fluttered in the wind. Once more sounded the tread of infantry and the clatter of cavalry as the U.S. Army marched back to war. This army covered a lifespan of roughly 1865 to 1890, and its home was in the West in surroundings of surpassing beauty or cruel harshness. Over mountain and mesa, and forest and lava bed, through parching, shriveling desert and the snowdrifts of the sub-zero plateau. Its adversaries were the Plains Indians, the finest light horsemen the world has ever seen, and the fierce, elusive tribes of the Southwest, the Kiowas and the Comanches, the Apaches, who swept back and forth across the Mexican border to harass Americans and Mexicans with equal impartiality.
The French Foreign Legion could not outmatch this army in its mixture of nationalities. It became one of the busiest sectors of the American melting pot. Negroes, many of them fresh from slavery, served in this cosmopolitan army under the discipline of white officers. They formed such splendid regiments as the 10th Cavalry. Their woolly hair and the shaggy hide coats that they wore in the winter campaign, they were christened the Buffalo Soldiers by the Indians, who said it would be bad medicine to scalp one of them.
No. This is Lewis Clark, again, pictured at about the age of 40, or perhaps later. You know, we all have visions of what slaves looked like. It's kind of hard to think of him as having been a slave. But this picture, I have about 1885, maybe a little bit later. He married a Mexican woman while he was on border duty, and upon his discharge from the Army, he returned with her to Renville, Ohio, where his brother William, who'd been discharged earlier, was already living. Both of these men were real marriage-minded. Each of them had three wives each, consecutively, of course. But they made up for lost time. They couldn't marry while they were in the service. Lewis Clark's young Mexican bride didn't like life in Ohio very much. Maybe a few Ohio winters made her decide that Mexico was preferable. I don't know. But at any rate, she packed up and went back to Mexico and left her son, who was called Sing, in Ohio with his father. And then Lewis married a second time. He had three children from the second marriage. But the story that's told is that the second wife mistreated the child from the first marriage, and that caused a lot of trouble, and he took her to court and divorced his wife, which was something that was pretty unheard of in those days. Well, he didn't get bitten again until he was in his 60s. At that time, he took his third wife, and he had six more children by her. And Norman, whose picture you saw earlier. So he and Angeline had two children, Howard and Jenny. This is an old tintype, and someone bent it in half so that the picture part of it across the center there, you know, sort of peeled off. It's sort of an enamel thing. So Howard Clark on the left is the man who would grow up to be my grandfather or my mother's dad. And this slide was taken about 1887 when my grandfather was 4 or 5 years old and his sister about six.
Granville or Rend?
Rend, R-E-N-D, Rendville, Ohio. It's a little south of Zanesville, I think, if you know where that is. These are big metropolises. When William Clark returned to Ohio from his Army service, he found work in the coal mines outside of Rendville. And when Howard was old enough, he followed his father into the mines. However, these mines were not especially rich in ore. Whether it was because the mines were worked out or whether there were other reasons, William soon left the mines, and leaving his family behind him in Ohio, he moved to Michigan to the area around Saginaw, where he found work in a lumber mill, which was at that time big business in Michigan.
People aboard the late ships would sometimes have to stand by for hours while huge rafts filled the rivers were broken up and corralled into the booms of the sawmills that lined both shores of Saginaw and Bay City. And at night, these mills sent the sharp, damp odor of freshly cut timber over the towns, and the northwest winds blew it over the harbors and out into the lakes.
You could always tell when you were passing Bay City, even at night. The deck of the ship was enveloped by the sweet, resinous smell of the millions of feet of pine board sawed, stacked, and ready to go to Chicago, build houses for the very people who were sailing by.
In Saginaw and Bay City, 112 sawmills lined the river, and there were 98 millionaire lumber barons in residence. 50 times a day, the bridges over the Saginaw lifted and lowered to let through the fleets of lake freighters carrying the white pine lumber to the lake port cities and down the Erie Canal and to Albany.
Time, do the children come up at 11?
Been everywhere and ain't no
Well, after a few years, Howard also left the mines, probably at about the age of 17 or 18, and he came to Saginaw to join his father. But instead of going into the sawmills, he decided to become a lumberjack. You can't see the picture very well, but I think the outfit is interesting, and he's got his axe there in his hand. And okay, this is a tintype that was taken about 1903, and I thought it was worth taking just for the clothing here.
The choice logs piled up through the autumn and winter around 1,000 camps in the Great Lakes region. The piles grew bigger and bigger in the 1870s and the 1880s. By 1889, there were about 112,000 men working the Great Lakes pineries. Throughout the slow days of the logging season, they slept like sardines in the bunkhouses, ate hurriedly in the cookhouses, saw no one but themselves, heard nothing but their own voices, the timber wolves, and the crash of falling trees.
$20 or $30 per month, they rushed into town for their big spree. They rolled into Saginaw by the train load for miles around.
It must have been during one of these trips to town that Howard here met my grandmother, Jessica Mays. I think maybe he swept her off her feet with his dapper appearance when he visited. I'm not sure the date of this particular picture, but we'll say it was before they were married, which that took place in 1903. And at the time he married my grandmother, he gave up his life in the lumber camps and took a job in the lumber mills instead. And in 1904, their only child, my mom, was born. And this is my mother at the age of 3. Linda's mother has lunch with her sometime. You're going to go back and your grandmother. Tease my mom about all the pictures you've seen of her. Do you remember when, Al, maybe you can do this for me now, the picture with the first picture with the tab on it that had Rosetta McLaren in it. If you would put, there should be a blank space right after this picture that shows now. No? Oh, wait a minute. I'm sorry. I forget. Don't pull it out. Hold on to it, though. Wrong. I'm sorry. Okay. This is a family portrait taken about the same time as the picture. And there's my grandfather is on your right. That's my grandmother, Jessica, in the center. And this is my grandfather's sister on the left. The sister's child is right in front of her, and my mother is in between her mom and dad. And this picture is taken about the same, well, this must be about 1907, I'd say, 1907, 1908. While the family was living in Saginaw, my grandmother Jessica had a job as a personal maid to Sophie Tucker, and she spent the spring and the fall traveling to Chicago and around the Midwest with Sophie Tucker. And thus my mother, to a large extent, was raised in a kind of extended family situation by her grandmother, Aurora, and her great-grandmother, Rosetta. Now, this is the point where I want to, did you put that slide in there? So if you remember Rosetta from the very first picture that I showed you, I'm going to show you this Rosetta at when she was, well, do say maybe 17, 18 years old, and now I'm going to show you this woman, same person, at the age of 83. And if you see the dark-skinned woman in the dark dress back there, that's the same woman at the age of, actually she's 81 when this picture was taken. She died 2 years later. So here you have, what you have here is the beginning shot, Rosetta McLaren, and this is her daughter, Aurora McLaren, who was married to the seaman that drowned on the Great Lakes. Mm-hmm. And this is her daughter, Jessica, who's my grandmother, and here you have, and this is my mother. So the four generations.
Jessica was Sophie Tucker's maid?
Yes.
Jessica's the one that went to Catholic school.
Yes, mm-hmm. You have good memories, okay. I think I had one more little reading here.
In the 1890s, the lumber operations reached their peak, then fell back to just a trickle in the days before World War I.
So as the lumber operations diminished, and my grandfather at that time was working in a lumber mill, the family packed up and moved from Saginaw, Michigan to Grand Rapids in about 1918. And it was in Grand Rapids that my mom finished high school, married, and that my brother and I were born, and the two generations of the family are buried in Grand Rapids. Today, there are Clarks and Normans scattered all throughout the states of Michigan and Ohio, and others as far west as California and as far east as New York City. And some of them disappeared over a century ago and were never heard of again. Some with their light skins and their blue eyes and blonde and red hair crossed the color line long ago and are heard from no more. But most of them put their hand on the plow and held on, as in the song. They were very little people. No books were written about them. They accomplished no great feats. In earlier days, they were not even acknowledged in the census reports, but simply subsumed under the names of the families they worked for or the families who owned them. But like other simple and little people, they contributed their share to the world we now inhabit, even though that share is barely acknowledged in our history books. And they prevailed, they held on. They had courage and integrity and pride and character, and I'm proud to be a part of them. Well, something. Well, it makes it easier for me to have.
Which was the seaman?
The seaman we didn't have a picture of. These were the Norman girls, William Clark. What's happening here? Norman girls. These red-headed Normans. You know, something very interesting, my mom is a baby, cute kid. Too bad we didn't take after her. What was I gonna say here? I've talked to Hazel, and Hazel's family comes from the same area in Michigan that these crosses came from, and I'm almost positive that somewhere down the line that she and I are related through these Normans. We'll check up on that one of these days. And you know, I was thinking about that, and I thought to myself, it would be the Shivers side of the family is from Cassopolis, right? And I thought to myself, you know, Mike has that red hair.
See, Pat, you seem to have an unusual collection of photographs compared to most anybody who came from the 1850s up. Why is that? I mean, you have more than my grandmother's. I've worked a lot with family history, and this is a very unusual amount as well as quality.
That's an interesting comment.
Was somebody a photographer or?
No. Mm-mm, because remember, we're talking about like three or four different families here. And I have a cousin, one of the Norman women in Ohio, who's really done a serious genealogical study on the family, who has a lot more of these photos than I have. But that's an interesting comment, because when, what was the name of John, who the Native American, what was his name? I sort of made that comment when he was showing the pictures that the Indian families had. And I wonder if it had, you know, I wonder if it were a culture, if it was a cultural thing, if black families and Native American families tended to have their pictures taken.
That's what I was going to ask you.
I think that at this time, black families tended to go for pictures. I don't know why. My family has a large collection, but no one knows the story like you do.
Don't know who they are.
Perhaps
yeah, you have to
establish an identity that they felt that they had lacked previously.
Yeah, I don't know that, but that sort of struck me. And it seems to me, if any of you have seen the collection that Zach Cooper has put together at the Historical Society for the Green, there's a Green County and or the Greens, and there are a lot of photographs. Vernon, there are a lot of photographs there as well.
Where is Washington Courthouse?
Washington Courthouse is either right outside of Gallipolis. It's down
south of Columbus.
South, maybe east or southeast of Columbus, I think. And right down. Right almost on the Ohio River.
I rode my bicycle.
Is this true that Mr. Watson
from Columbus?
If so, why then I've gone hunting for the dead in Christ?
Thousands of pictures. I don't know who these people are.
But my grandmother.
You just treasure them. Someday you'll be.
It depends, I think,
well, I
on.
They're strangers, you know.
That's all right.
It depends.
You're going to need a genealogist.
I related to a whole bunch of.
I think
the genealogist that has matching pictures, and they'll be able to tell you who they are, and then you'll find out, because it's more than one of those pictures made every time.
I think it depends a lot, too, on whether you have someone in the family who's interested in that kind of thing. My grandmother kept had a diary in which she, I mean, as I say, I don't know how much some of these things conflict. So some of the things she said, my mother thinks are partly her imagination, or she's made up some stories because they're conflicting stories. But she's gone back two or three generations before what I've got here with you know, the written connections.
Now that's the same one that the Catholic education.
Right? Yeah,
right.
She was a little artistic and liked to write.
Well, it was important at a time, particularly when blacks were not even being counted on birth certificates. Their births weren't being registered. The cattle, pedigreed cattle were being registered, and the slaves were not. And the census records included the count of the cattle, and they were lucky if they could include the count of the slaves. So it was really important if a black could read or write, to write, you know, they no doubt felt impelled to keep everything they could. It was the only identity they could preserve.
Oh, cattle.
What strikes me is a 32 racial identity, the racial category. Because that's so little of what people consider
you,
black.
That's
black.
Right, you can't.
And then it only comes out more vividly to me that racial identification is only related to the category, and that we are so influenced negatively and positively according to our own sense of view of our racial category. And certainly in very obvious to me, at least, it was very little of what people call black through the years we have owned, except for the fact that it had very concrete results, in the sense that if you weren't counted anywhere, you just were sort of made
what
a non-person.
What I'm saying is that in the United States of living territories, you can wonder if whatever,
Yeah, what Carolyn, I think, is pointing out, it very shows up very clearly in those two pictures of the two Clark brothers that came out of Bowling Green, Virginia. Now, we're pretty positive that they were born slaves, and yet either one of them, both of them, William Clark I knew, the Lewis Clark I didn't, but William Clark I knew, and you couldn't tell that he was a black man. I'm not sure whether he had blue eyes or not. My grandfather, I know, had one blue eye and one brown eye. But
one further observation is that I'm very happy that you did this, because there are many of us who associated with the term black always consider that black people came from very poor circumstances, and ghetto, like all of us have come from the ghetto. We all, poor and whatever. And I'm very glad that you have this.
I think few people stop to think that there were black people who were working on those ships in the Great Lakes, that were out cutting lumber in the Wisconsin and Michigan pineries, working in those lumber mills. But of course, then most of these people were in service jobs. Though I mean, it wasn't they weren't
exactly.
Oh, I got those. The readings were from various different places. I think the one about the Great Lakes and the lumber was something to do with the Michigan lumber industry, and then one was the Buffalo Soldiers, and I don't remember any longer what the books were.
Carolyn's observation is really interesting, because I think it points out the dilemma for, I've got a niece and nephew. And one of them, I think, is going to decide that she's black, and the other one is going to decide that she's white. I mean, that's that when you're sort of on the cusp, you make these sort of choices that, which group to identify with. Sort of like deciding if you're German or Portuguese.
Yes, well, I think that's... Oh, okay. You can all come up to me, and I'd be glad to talk to you after the service. Yeah.
Let me suggest that we don't have announcements now. We do have a general meeting tonight at 7:30. So if there are any urgent announcements that must be made, all of us are going to be present for the meeting. Plants, yes. Plants can't wait.
Georgina.
Two weeks ago, I introduced two new members, actually one of the two new members. Jim Lorman was here, his wife Ann Forbes wasn't. Ann is here today with their son, John. See, artificial distinction. And what is your name?
She may just be in the audience.
In introducing new members, I thought it might be a good idea if we asked them to tell a little bit about themselves. And so I've asked Jim and Ann to just take a second to do that today. So, if you would.
Well, I guess we haven't got time to go into large, long biographies. I'm also a biologist, and I teach at Edgewood College. I teach biology and science to science majors. And I'm more interested in developing interdisciplinary kinds of courses also. I think both of us have spent probably 15 or 20 years since we were involved in any sort of semi, any kind of organized religion.
We're semi.
Yeah. So that, yeah, the semi part is one reason that they got us to join here. I think that we both felt that we could use some kind of organization in terms of our fulfilling our spiritual and social conscious side of us. And that's what we hope to do.
What's happening next week? Anybody know?
Prairie Creators.
Prairie Creators, that's right. That's good.
Anybody who's interested in being that.
I'm sorry, I just have one short commercial announcement. Many of you have seen our Erica's and my announcements over there. We got the paper for those announcements at Pat Watkins' daughter store, Paper Curia, which is located where?
At 210 North Henry.
On Fair Friday, on the 12th of May, right after service, come to the church and witness our vows.